Department of State, we support a global workforce. We have 278 locations globally, all the embassies overseas, posts and missions, as well as our civil service staff, and of course the Foreign Service as well, which comprises about 75, 80,000 total employees served across all of the different flavors.
And what types of processes are supported by global talent management? Because HR is kind of a broad term.
As is my job. We pretty much handle all of the HR. So we do all the personal action processing, which is really the actions that get you paid, that get you promoted, we do telework agreements, we do reasonable accommodations, we have workflows for case management, from everything from benefits and benefit elections, onboarding, we do an onboarding platform. So we have a wide variety of tools. And if, as you can imagine, in today's times, there's a nexus, every single thing we do has a nexus with technology. So there isn't much that's done without some form of technology, and that's part of my job, not only to make sure that we have technology, but to make sure that the actual technology kind of interacts with all the rest of the technology that we have.
And isn't there a twist, too, in the State Department in that you have fairly significant numbers of foreign nationals working for State, because that's who are often the day-to-day staff in embassy locations?
Correct. We have about 56,000 locally employed staff, and I actually have a personnel system, an actual platform that manages those employees. We have a system where we track them. We track all the overseas presence, both our direct hire and our locally employed staff. And of course, they have pay and promotion and performance evaluation, everything that goes with their jobs, times however many different countries that we actually support. So, yes.
Sure. And give us a sense of the technology base as it stands now to support all of this activity. Sounds like a lot of applications and maybe some legacy code.
Yeah, that's an overused word, but yes. So we have primarily PeopleSoft as our back end platform. We have one for overseas and one for domestic. I manage a suite of about 70 different software applications. And that ranges everything from a little like phone book application all the way through to a very complex evaluation product, position management, classification. I mean, if it smells of HR, and to your point, I have classification system for foreign, for locally employed staff. I have one for domestic. So yes, it spans the entire gamut of applications.
And does State do its own payroll, or do you use the National Finance Center or the Interior Business Center, or how does that interconnect?
Well, interesting. State does do its own payroll, and we are the OPM for Foreign Service. So anybody in any Foreign Service employees, and then State Department is not the only agency that has, Commerce has them, Treasury has Foreign Service employees. We are their retirement provider. So when they retire, we pay their annuities in their retirement from the State Department. So yes, we have the global comptroller. And interestingly enough, at the State Department, payroll is a completely separate entity from HR. When there are a lot of federal agencies, HR and payroll are together. We are in separate bureaus here at the department.
Interesting. So is that a challenge for you, or is it just the way it works?
Well, you know, it is a challenge, although we have a great working relationship with them. I think ultimately, you know, when it comes to technology and having systems talk to each other, it's always a challenge when you have to integrate platforms. So, but no, I mean, they do, you have to understand, other than the military, the Foreign Service is one of the most mobile agencies and, you know, groups of individuals. We move about a third of those on a permanent change of station movements every year. So the comptroller manages that, the moving of their good, you know, payment of allowances and all the different things that go along with relocations, along with special differential pay and all the other things that happen for folks that are overseas. So it's a pretty complicated area, and obviously they have that expertise. So
right, and it's probably a totally different situation than, say, the military, which also has permanent changes of station, but it's different to the pay.
Yes,
considerations
yes.
Aren't the same and so on.
Of course. Yeah. But that is a good example at parallel. If somebody's has an understanding, that's kind of the way the Foreign Service works, although it's a little bit more of a, they have a lot more input into the process than they do in the military. So,
but in some ways then, getting back to the bigger question, you are a shared services provider in that sense of taking care of annuities and other services for all Foreign Service employees, State or whatever department
yeah,
they might
know,
be part
actually,
of.
Yeah, actually, I think so in a reduced state. I mean, obviously, we don't do their payroll, but we do their retirement. So in a way, yes, we are. And I know there has been discussions about actually offering our payroll to other federal agencies, but obviously that's not in my area of expertise.
So. Well, let's talk about the technology base that supports all of this. You mentioned PeopleSoft, but 70 applications. Is this all hosted on State Department data centers? Are you cloud yet, or how does that all work?
We're hybrid. You know, we are somewhat of, we're a semi-intelligent intel agency. So most of our personnel systems are on-prem. We do not host those in the cloud, but we do use ServiceNow platform as a kind of a front end to our most of our, like an employee portal, I guess is the best way to describe it. We've used that as a platform to bring the modern user experience to the users without the requirement of completely re-engineering every platform. You know, one of this, to your point earlier, we have a lot of legacy code. Well, legacy means more than just old. It could also mean things that have, you know, decades of business logic built into them. And so a strategy that I used early on when I first took over was, let's take these business applications, wrap them in a web services kind of an environment, and then serve them to a more modern front end. It was a really quick way of getting that user experience win without that huge investment of completely re-engineering everything into a new platform. You know, I'm somewhat suspect, and obviously the world of vendor lock-in, you know, I want to keep as much corporate IP within my own control as opposed to putting it into a third-party platform with, because they go away, they change, and eventually you have to take that logic and put it somewhere else. So that's been kind of a strategy from a modernization perspective.
Yeah, tell us more about how you're modernizing, which applications you're going with, and what your strategies are for some of those.
Well, I think the majority of the modern, most of it happens because it has to. And you can imagine there's an interesting convergence right now. If you've been, I know you've been following that, we have the zero trust mandate. So we have the zero trust requirement levied upon us. So I have to evaluate not only where are we at from a modernization perspective, but where are we at a compliance perspective, because security is very important. So we, where that nexus happens, those are the applications that get the most attention the earliest. So we really focus on making sure that we are remediating all of our vulnerabilities from a security standpoint. And then, of course, that modern user experience, because that is another strategy. Even our secretary has said that you know, that modernization effort has always been a focus to improve the user experience. So that typically does it. And then, of course, if you understand the way that we work from a organization, we're very cyclic as an organization, right? We have summer bidding season, we have winter bidding season, we have the civil service performance management cycle ends in January, the foreign service performance cycle ends in April. So we typically plan our modernization around those cycles to say, okay, we've just finished that cycle. Now we can launch into the modernization tool that's going to replace that for the next season or the next cycle that we come along. And then, you know, ultimately, of course, we have end of year pay adjustments and COLA. You know, it's an interesting trying to find the gaps in there to actually do things. And that I always tell people, HR modernization is somewhat unique in the fact that we don't get to stop doing our jobs while we're modernizing. We have to continue to fly the plane while we're working on it, because pay doesn't stop, promotion doesn't stop. These cycles continue and the systems have to support it.
And on the issue of that customer experience or the user experience, it seems like the trend more and more, and maybe you're already there, is as much self-service on the part of employees as possible. They can take care of their own business, and where that seemed maybe like an imposition in the early days of it, now most people actually prefer that because it's faster and they can get kind of instant notification that something took, if you will.
Right. Well, it's funny. That's the mobile world has, you know, the banks and everything else. Most everybody goes, why can't HR be like my bank where I can do it all myself, right? We can move money. We can do so many things. And that's put a lot of pressure on us from a user experience standpoint. But that also means then that things have to be very intuitive, very direct. And as we know, the federal government necessarily doesn't align very well with a lot of the simple things due to rules and regulations and things like that. But we are evolving there. And I think ultimately the goal has always been give them enough to understand, you know, part of it is, because HR is such a broad and complex situation, half of the battle is actually finding out what the problem is so we can solve it. So that's where we put a lot of our energy, is in that interactive, like, okay, well, what are you trying to do? What is the situation right now? And this is where AI really starts to earn its pay, if you think about it, because I can tell you I'm worried about X, and then I can ask certain interactive questions to really hone in on what your problem is, then I can get you to the help the quickest. And that's kind of where we've been focusing a lot of our energy recently, is to really find out, how do I get to your problem the quickest? And how can I, and we have 4 customer experience strategists on staff in GTM, how do we actually interact with the end user so that when they get there, they know exactly what to do and they know how to interact with our systems? Because half the battle is collecting the information, but the other half of it is actually making the user feel like they can give you what you're asking for.
Yeah, there's almost two classes of questions you can answer with automation and so forth. One is, you know, what is the State Department policy? And that means feeding all the documentation that exists into, say, some kind of an algorithm or a generative AI situation. Then the other is this particular person's situation. And you probably get both types of questions.
We do. And part of it is some of the strategies and techniques we're using, and then we do this during the business analysis phase, is really we end up with these what we call dynamic questionnaires. Based on the answer you give me, it tells me which question to ask you next. And we can literally drill down and get to pretty specific on what somebody's issue is to get their problem resolved. But they have a broad category, to your point. That's the first level. The second level is a more of an interactive situation. And we've got a couple of strategies we're working on right now to actually dynamically generate a questionnaire to make that self-serve experience the best that it can be based on your current situation.
Before the break, we were talking about that customer experience and customizing that for each person that would come, each employee that would, you know, interact with the HR system. How does that work in terms of bots versus human interaction? And if it's an automated type of response, what's the foundational platform that can generate this for you? What type of AI are you looking at?
Well, I mean, I have to say kudos to the department. We are really leaning in on AI. Our chief data officer, Matt Gravis, the secretary's been very forward-leaning on it. So we've already started implementing generative AI internal to the department. I mean, the biggest challenge in the federal government has been, I don't want my data going outside into other people's systems. So we've actually implemented it internally. I was just on a briefing the other day, just exciting to see where we've got this internal, we call it State Chat right now. It's going to get a new name, I'm sure. But we use it right now for generative AI, and you can upload documents and then ask questions of those documents. Well, you can imagine, to your point earlier about, you know, rules, regulations, policy. Gosh, if I could upload 100 policy documents and then interactively ask a question about it, that's powerful. And it's much more, it brings it to the masses. Like you say, I don't have to be a guru in order to get it. And the beauty of what they're building right now internally is every single answer comes with a little icon with an eye, and you click that eye and it shows you where it got the data, which is the other half of AI nowadays, right? Not only do I want the answer, but I want to know where it came from so that I can make sure that it isn't a hallucination. So we're really heading down a really cool path. That's due to go live here probably August, September timeframe. Very exciting for the whole entire department. And we're going to leverage that as well. I think from the HR perspective, obviously, we're looking at things from a benefits and other strategy session, which is different than policy, right? But this is still the same codified in rules and regulations that we can then load in and actually let people interact with.
And very early on, we talked about the idea of hiring and onboarding. You have processes for that. That's a big challenge for so many agencies, is try to speed up hiring and try to make the onboarding experience a positive one. And maybe in the long run, help retention. And once once people encounter a solid HR self-service system, that helps with retention. What plans do you have maybe to extend this type of automation and machine learning powered applications to the hiring and onboarding part of it?
Well, I mean, we are, you know, and you make a very good point. When you have a new employee onboarding, that's their first interaction with you. So, you know, and you remember those commercials back in the day, you never have a second chance to make a first impression. Boy, that matters, especially with HR. So one of the things we did a couple years ago, we actually put a very modern platform up for all of our incoming. We started with Foreign Service because we bring in, you know, 200 or 300 a pop, 2 or 3 times a year. So we've got a steady stream of applicants. We have the entire HR online onboarding experience now where we pull it from our hiring system into the platform. The person augments their data. They only enter their data once. We generate all the downstream forms and we onboard them, and we don't touch their data at all until it comes to the final offer. Well, that modern experience, that gains you a lot of equity, right? Because there are going to encounter some older systems. Let's be honest. We're still working through them all. But that whole modern experience, and it you're right, it helps with retention. It helps with their first impression. Like, okay, these guys are pretty modern. We're mobile enabled. We make sure that they have it. And I will tell you the one thing that is a little bit of a secret at the department. OPM announced not too long ago that they were going to allow federal employees to have benefits on day one because, and you know who facilitated that? We did. Our Deputy Assistant Secretary went to OPM and said, look, we have an onboarding platform where we have people ready to go on day one, because normally that 2-week delay between onboarding and your first paycheck is for HR to finish up all the paperwork. Well, we're so efficient now, we could literally offer benefits on day one of employment. And that's out right now for public comment. But if that happens, that changed the whole federal government by we were so efficient on onboarding somebody that you can get your benefits, your health benefits, the first day of employment, where normally it's been you have to wait 2 weeks.
So, right. In this day and age, even 2 weeks without health care coverage is kind of scary for people.
It is. Very. Especially if you're transitioning from another job, you're liable for that 2-week gap no matter what. And we feel like we've gotten there. It's pretty cool.
And it strikes me that given how far-flung state is and that you are deploying self-service and AI-powered applications, that the cloud must be kind of the foundational infrastructure that you're looking at.
It is and it isn't. Look, the promise of cloud has never been realized. All right, if we're going to be frank, because the original premise on cloud was let somebody else manage it, right? They run the servers, they patch the servers, they run the whole entire thing. But nobody ever actually said how much that was really going to cost. So we have all this infrastructure and we have our servers and our annual refresh and all that. And then we go to the cloud and we're like, well, first of all, in the transition to the cloud, nobody planned for that. So you have cloud and you have on-prem. We don't have budget to do both, but you're paying double for a while you're trying to transition. Then we find out, oh, there's an ingress charge. Well, you got to pay to put your data in. Oh, there's an egress charge. Oh, you got to pay to take your data out. Oh, I got a platform with Microsoft and a platform with Amazon. Oh, the two talk to each other. You got to pay to move the data around. All of a sudden, all of these expenses popped up that we never really had to deal with before. And magically, all of a sudden, it's not as attractive as it actually was at the beginning because the original reason and intent. Now, combine that with the world of virtualization. Well, now having a physical server isn't nearly as important as having a VM that's compliant and current with its patches and updates. A little easier to do now in a virtual world than it isn't. So it's kind of weird how the industry evolved to support us through virtualization, but then we're like, well, you know, we can do that virtualization ourselves and save all that extra money of giving it to you and then having you charge us every time we look over our shoulder. And I can tell you that's a big concern when it comes to these larger platforms and tools. It's like, we just don't have the resource, the depth of funding that is to realize cloud. And this is my opinion. I'm not speaking for our CIO, Kelly Fletcher. She probably has an opinion on this as well. But I can tell you just when you start doing the numbers, they just don't add up. And at some point, we got to pay the bills, you know, and the money's not been there.
So. Right. So it sounds as if you could somehow go completely to that operating expense model and no longer have the capital expense, the CapEx. Hybrid means you're dealing with both.
Right. And I would say for as much as cloud has also been supposedly more reliable and more robust, have you been paying attention to the news? What's happening? Well, we've had major outages from very large cloud providers. We've had vulnerabilities that by a particular vendor that permeated the entire industry. So all of a sudden, all of these advantages that we looked at having this more secure, safe, and less expense, there's also exposure and liabilities there as well. I'm not trying to be anti-cloud. I'm just saying, man, it's been an eye-opening experience if you're living it, trying to actually make it happen and then the realities of the real true costs.
Sure. So what is your ideal to be state then with respect to infrastructure?
Wow, I think the jury's still out on this. And reason being is that, you know, we're all going with virtualization and all of this others. And I don't know if you paid attention to the industry, but Broadcom just bought out VMware. Well, we're looking at a 300% increase in licensing costs. What do you do when you're already established on a platform or a tool and somebody buys the vendor and then raises your prices by 300%? What are you going to do? So, I mean, those are things that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis on, oh my gosh, now it's going to even get more expensive. And we're relying on a particular technology that now is almost cost prohibitive to use. So this is just the reality of the industry is you're trying to find your way. And it's almost like you feel like a rat in a maze. You find a cost-effective solution, and somebody comes in and says, no, I think I'm going to buy them and raise your prices, and we're stuck. There's nothing we can do.
Sounds like the case for open source.
And you know what? We are definitely looking at a lot of open source these days, and there's a really good movement in the federal government right now with open source. Because obviously the open source risk is provenance and who's had their fingers in the code and do we have the appropriate controls in place. I mean, they each come with their own set of risks.
All right. So maybe summarize then the modernization effort, where you hope to be in the next, say, year or so.
Well, I'm still kind of weaving my way through my legacy platforms. So I call it subsumption. I'm subsuming a lot of these tools into my current platform, which is ServiceNow, as my front end. I'm using that as a strategy to, because I've already built all this connectivity. I have integration with my personnel system, with my electronic personnel records. All those integrations are built on one platform. So as I absorb these little services into this platform, the amount of work I do is minimal because I only have to do the specific piece of the business logic, not all the other integrations that individual applications used to have. So I've really seen a lot of economies of scale of being able to absorb a platform. I don't have all the extra integrations to manage. I don't have all these extra, this overhead, because every single integration point now is a vulnerability potentially, and it has to be remediated if there's security. So this is reducing my footprint while consolidating and giving the modern user experience. So it's kind of like it's a win-win, but it's a slow process.